Today, it's our economic update for June. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance and the List as well, latest post covering finance and property news. Well, this is my monthly economic update recorded with Nuggets News.
Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News, or our monthly Australian housing and economy update with our friend Martin North coming to us from over in the UK. How are you, Martin?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you, Alex, and a lot going on. Hope you're down in Australia through winter, which has been a bit weird down there. It's been weird up here as well.
Yeah, it's been pretty good in Tassie, still doing lots of bushwalking and that type of thing. But I wanted to start off with, a bit of a rant today. I'll share a few ideas and ask you for your opinion, because every week we kind of say it's every month we say how interesting the world is and what's happening, and we're heading into these elections. We've got China conducting these big war drills now around Taiwan, Russia conducting these nuclear war games near the US, you know, all the stuff going on in Israel, Palestine, and then it's like Ukraine is this distant memory, and everyone's kind of forgotten about COVID and lockdowns. But I think in terms of the UK and the elections, what we're starting to see is that maybe conservative wave and people saying, hey, it's time that we look after ourselves for a little bit, because inequality is just skyrocketing. And we've seen in places like, France, where we had the Yellow Vest movement, and in some of these other European countries where the farmers are protesting. And it's just this, idea that politicians have become so out of touch with the reality of the average person and what people, citizens of that country actually want, no longer, representing their view. So a little bit of a rant. It ties all back to, Bitcoin and crypto in some ways. Overnight, we had China come out and say, hey, maybe Bitcoin is a store of value because of its scarcity, and maybe Ethereum trying to build the new internet is the new digital oil. So I think all these systems that give hopefully power back to the people, another part of this puzzle is the world seems to be changing. But Martin, you've got more experience than me. Have you ever seen a more interesting time in recent memory, or what are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, it's certainly pretty crazy, I think. And, data came out overnight in the UK to say that, because there's an election running, and we might touch on some of the data on that shortly, but more than half of people now don't trust politicians. They think they put their own party interests ahead of the country, which is higher than it's ever been. We've also got more people saying Brexit was a mistake than ever before. And generally, the story is that the bifurcation of those that are still doing quite well and are quite comfortable financially are in one camp, but there's a growing number of people who are in another camp where the system is not actually supporting them, where they're not actually able to get ahead, where in real terms they're going backwards. They can't get access to public services, healthcare, or whatever else. We've got more potholes than we've ever had in the road, so the road repairs are all over the place. The trains don't work. We have contaminated water. Wherever you look, the basic fabric of society seems to be decaying. And I guess I've got a view that says there's a reason for this. The reason is that politicians have made bad decisions over the last couple of decades. And, whilst they're chasing various, aspirational outcomes and doing all sorts of things and throwing a lot of money into defence and other things, they're not looking after their communities. And I think this is quite broad, not just in the UK, not just in Australia, but in other countries too. So for me, the question becomes, what is government for? And unfortunately, government has, set off on a journey to a future which is perhaps more dystopian than we would like, with more centralized control, more, do this, do that, don't do the other, less focus on supporting people and enabling people and businesses to grow and develop in the communities that they're in. So there's a lot that's broken. On the other hand, I suppose when the elections come, it gives you a chance to raise some of these issues. The trouble is that There's a guy called Gallagher here in the UK who's, not a mainstream politician now, was, but he makes the point that both sides of politics are two sides of the same bum. You know, they're both basically in the same political sphere, minor differences, but we need something a bit more radical and a bit more different. So, whether we'll get it, because the political system is designed to self-sustain its own outcomes rather than actually generating the broader society, which then takes you into, so are there alternatives like Bitcoin and those sorts of things? Are there alternative strategies And I think there are, and I think there need to be, because, well, we're going into a very dark period, I think, at the moment. And, you know, the final thing to say is a lot of people are talking about we're now in a pre-war phase. It's almost as if, well, maybe war will be the thing that will actually be the last step in the game for politicians who try and maintain control and keep control, and gives them a cover for doing a lot of other stupid stuff. So, yeah, I'm quite concerned about where we are. I've been around for a long, long time. I don't think I've ever seen it so dark.
When all else fails, go to war, I think is the old saying, isn't it, Martin? So
yeah, unfortunately.
Let's dive into these great slides of yours. So UK inflation.
Yeah, so, you know, there was a very, very interesting little piece here. This is actually from a screenshot from Sky News, because inflation came in at 2.3%. And Rishi Sunak used that to say, right, let's go to the election because inflation has normalised, right? But you only have to look back to 2021. Real prices have gone up at least 20%, and that's on the official numbers. Now, you could apply this same chart to Australia or Canada or wherever else you want to look. The truth is that the costs of living are way higher, and whilst they might be coming back a little, but they're using this as a screen to try and actually get people to vote for them. Now, in fact, what will happen is that inflation will go up again later in the year because it's a set of the base effects. But this is misdirection on a grand scheme. And we're seeing it not just here, but also in Australia too, that inflation may be coming back. It's still growing, but the net growth over the last 2 or 3 years is absolutely massive, which is why more people are under huge pressure.
Yeah, exactly. And UK unemployment ticks higher at the same time.
Yeah, and the other point there is the other data is showing that, well, you know, wages growth around 6%, but unemployment still rising. So the signals in terms of economic outcomes are actually quite murky. And unfortunately, what we find is through election cycle in particular, politicians are cherry picking little pieces of data that tries to actually prove their point, whilst the truth is that overall, structurally in the UK, there's a massive deficit. None of the parties are actually seeing a way out of that bind. So they're sort of messing around the edge. And in the meantime, the overall economy is pretty flat. And if you go to the next slide, this is the true revelation in the UK. UK has had lost decades on a per capita GDP growth perspective. In other words, in real terms, you know, if you go back to 2008 onwards, households on average in Australia, in Australia and in the UK and pretty much wherever else you look, gone sideways. And this is the truth. This is why so many people are actually now feeling it, because effectively the economy isn't working for ordinary people.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the big debates has been whether or not we're going to have a second round of inflation and if we're actually going to get cuts or hikes are going to be next. So it's interesting we've started to see Canada and some of these other countries actually cut heading into that election time.
Yeah, well, we just touch on Canada because they did actually cut to 4.75%. Now, they lifted rates a lot higher and they started seeing unemployment rise quite substantially. The key indicators of inflation, as you can see there on the right, have started to come back. So Canada has started to cut, although there's not necessarily a whole series of cuts planned. It probably is going to be one, and then we'll see what happens. So their data is dependent. But the next slide also shows that from a GDP per capita basis, and for me, this lens is the most critical. This is, what is it like for real people in terms of the economy, right? And in fact, you can see there that Canada is, well, living standards are some of the weakest compared with some of the others there. And the other way to think about it, if you look at Canada's real disposable income versus property prices, you can see just how skewed the property sector is. So there's, again, another signal of a broken economy is when house prices run way ahead of people's real income. And guess what? That's exactly the same in Australia too. So what we're seeing here is, whilst there's a little bit of a turn, and you know, Canada's the first G7 to move, it doesn't signal necessarily everybody else is going to follow.
And just compared to Australia, like you said, we didn't raise rates anywhere near as high, so maybe they've got that freedom to cut a little bit and whatnot, whereas we still don't, which we'll get to in a second.
Absolutely, yeah. So I'm afraid the Australian story is quite different. The inflation number is a lot higher in Australia. Unemployment's a bit lower in Australia. But as we'll see, there's no headroom at the moment to cut rates. But the ECB did, and in fact, they cut rates to 3.75%. But despite the fact that inflation reported higher just beforehand. So, I mean, what? And it's interesting now that Lagarde is basically saying there's a long way to go before inflation is defeated. We have to be vigilant. We're going to watch the data. It doesn't necessarily mean they're actually going to cut again ahead either. This is almost that they will sort of talk themselves over the last 6 months or so into cutting now, despite the fact that the data doesn't necessarily warrant it. So this is a nutty decision, and we'll be interested to see what happens post that. And in fact, other issues in Eurozone, we've had the French going to an election now because the right wing has basically taken a stronger stand across Europe. So the French president is trying to actually counter that. Not surprisingly, then the market's got quite a lot weaker because of that as well. So we've got a lot of uncertainty in the Eurozone. And of course, you mentioned Ukraine. The Ukraine conflict still rumbles on. The official reporting of what's going on is probably understating the negative impact on Ukraine. And the story here is that there's a lot more to play out. And also, we've seen that gas prices have started to rise again. So that could be another inflationary force coming down the tubes.
Absolutely. Plenty happening in Europe, but over to the US now, and we've got the Fed rate decision tonight.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a CPI report and a Fed decision coming out later today, but the data has been conflicting. So on some, measures, things are a little bit weaker. But then the non-farm payroll came out the end of last week with a huge spike, 272,000. And there's another report that came out from the Fed that said that household wealth had grown dramatically in the first quarter. Guess what? That's because of house price growth, but very importantly, share wealth has grown, those sorts of things. So we've got really conflicting signals. I don't think that the Fed is going to cut rates when they actually next meet. I think that they are going to say we'll have to be data dependent because there's still a surge of higher inflation than they expected. That hasn't really changed. So once again, the question we've really got to ask ourselves is, are central banks who are just using the rear view mirror to try and actually decide policy doing the right thing? Are they misreading the data? Is the data being skewed because, for example, employment data is being misrepresented? I think it probably is. Bunch of questions. So the truth is that the inflation battle and the central bank interventions are not over. And therefore, going back to right to the top of the show, do we think they know what they're doing? I have the view that they probably don't. And by the way, I had a long chat with Steve Keen on my show last night, live show. And Steve and I discussed why it is that central bankers are making bad decisions. The truth is they're economists, and the economists don't understand how the economy works. So that's one of the reasons why we're getting bad decisions.
Yeah, I've been a long time fan of Steve Keen's work as well. So I might chat a bit more of that after we finish, Mark. But next up, the US unrealized losses hang heavy. And this is something I think we've both talked about a lot. These banks holding all these bonds to maturity are sitting on huge losses now.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting observation here is that now the size of those losses are continuing to grow, held to maturity securities and available for sale securities as well. PIMCO came out with a warning of more regional bank failures and the regional banks trading now below their weekly support levels. This is something which we're going to see, I think, playing out. The longer that rates are higher, the more that bonds are actually, pricing very differently from where they were, means there are lots of losses. Those losses ultimately will have to be realized. And by the way, the Federal Reserve also has massive losses on its books as well because it's holding a lot of bonds too. So, a lot of stupidity, and in fact, a lot of central banks are in negative territory as well as a lot of regional banks. A lot of the regional banks in the US, though, is where I think the action will be. And there was also a report that came out that said that commercial real estate is now starting to bite as well, and that's another impact, particularly in the regional, and there's more than 500 regional banks in the US, of which many are now heavily exposed. Watch this space for more negative news, I think.
All right. So US debt continues to rise steeply, but this is actually the debt maturing within a year.
Yeah, and this is quite important, right? Because they're still pumping the bond markets. And in fact, there were issuances this week, which actually went quite well. But I just wanted to highlight that over the next year or so, you know, there's a record $9.3 trillion of US debt maturing and going to have to be replaced. So they've got this debt machine. So whilst the Federal Reserve might be dialing back its balance sheet and holding interest rates high to try and actually sort of dampen the economy a little bit, the Treasury in the US is still pumping like mad and is still going to print more. And in fact, the total US debt is never been higher. And of course, that's up to an election. The question is whether the other side, if they win, will actually change that. Probably not. The question is, who are going to buy these bonds? And that could well lift rates into the medium term simply because of the supply and demand drivers.
All right. And looking quickly at the stock market in the US.
I chuckle because, of course, the market at the top line, this is the S&P 500, is still doing pretty well, you know, keep touching new highs. But when you actually look at it carefully, it's all about the AI space. And in fact, the chart on the right there shows you that the breadth is very narrow. So it's a small number, you know, the NVIDIAs and the Apples and those sorts of stocks are driving the market, but it's very narrowly based. If you look in retail, it's pretty weak. Some of the banking sector is looking quite wobbly now. And so stocks are about 30% overvalued relative to the long-term trends. I don't believe that the AI revolution is going to be able to support the whole economy over the next 2 to 3 years. I'm expecting that as we come into September, October, we're going to start seeing markets react negatively. And of course, then we go into the election, so more uncertainty there. So whilst we are very fully priced in, we're overpriced. I think markets are going to have to adjust.
Yep. Okay. Next up, moving to Australia, where, as we talked about before, inflation's still pretty strong and we don't have as much room to cut because we didn't go as high in terms of when we raised rates.
Yeah, so the last inflation was 3.6%. That was higher than 3.5%. Now, you know, monthly numbers, it might move around again. But basically, the markets are now thinking, oh, it's going to be next year before we see any rate cuts. CBA's now changed their tune, ANZ as well. They were both expecting cuts, you know, through this year. In fact, CBA has been ultra bullish on cuts. They were thinking March, then May, and then they keep kicking it forward. Truth is that there is very little wriggle room available at the moment. Inflation is still stubbornly high. We've got significant additional stimulus coming through because of the tax cuts and because of the, you know, for example, up in Queensland, the government's playing politics there and throwing a lot of money into the economy ahead of the election later in the year. That's going to be inflationary. So wherever you look, the inflationary forces are still pretty strong. A lot of it's services related, a lot of it's wage related. And we've also, of course, got the low wage results coming through as well. So all of those things are going to have a significant... The budget basically, you know, looked at as though it could actually ease a little bit of inflation in the short term, but then the RBA said, well, we're going to look through that. So there's no real good news, whichever way you look at it. Rates are going to stay high for longer. That's going to have a huge impost on households.
Yeah, and next up, Australian GDP just ticking higher and avoiding that negative print.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've seen it really, really low. The latest data, by the way, from the UK came out, and that was flat for the month, having been slightly higher last quarter. So GDP is still a problem. And this is total GDP. This is, you know, the number, not the GDP per capita. But if you go to the GDP per capita on the next slide, you can see that that's actually gone really, really negative. It's down 2% or so, 0.4% down in the month. But then Bullock gave evidence in front of Parliament saying that the GDP per capita is not really that important. Well, I would argue, no, she's wrong. The GDP per capita is probably the most important measure that we can have because it tells you the true impact on real households. And what this shows you is that in terms of Australian households, they're going backwards. They've been going backwards for quite a long time. Real wages growth has been negative for, you know, 10, 15 years or so. The GDP per capita continues to degrade, which means that whilst we're having more people coming into the country in the top line, dynamo might be bigger, the result on individuals is actually not positive. And I'm afraid that this comment from the Reserve Bank really shocked me, and I found her attitude really quite surprising, because the truth is that the only measure that I think we should be looking at is GDP per capita.
Yes, I completely agree with that. So, households are rating their savings to survive after we get that big spike with all the handouts during COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is the other part of the national results, as it were, the national accounts. And so savings ratio is continuing to dive, a lot of people raiding their savings. But there was another interesting observation, and this is the question of, but not everybody's in the same boat, right? So that in fact, what they're saying is that there are some households, some older households without mortgages, they're benefiting from the share markets, they've got high values in their property, maybe they've got investment properties, they don't have HECS debts, et cetera, et cetera. So they are actually a group that are doing pretty well, whereas there's another group that are doing really, really badly. And so part of the difficulty is that the RBA is caught between trying to actually adjust the overall settings for the economy. But in the meantime, we are putting a huge burden on more than 50% of the households who have mortgages, particularly younger people. Maybe they have HECS debts as well, and their wages growth may not be as strong. So there's a real, real problem. And it's the same problem I'm seeing in other countries too, in the UK, as we discussed earlier, with this bifurcation between the haves and the have-nots. So structurally, we have got a really big problem. And unfortunately, what you find is that the politicians don't necessarily get just how bad it is for a lot of real ordinary Australians at the moment.
Yeah, and just this is something that we've spoken about in detail. Again, it was good to see this article because this is exactly, I think it might have even been last month's episode. We really highlighted how this is playing out in terms of the tax breaks, and yeah, we talk about the haves and the have-nots, but now it's like the old and the young people and the differences in how the policies affect them really driving inequality.
Yeah, and it is an interesting question because when you actually are thinking about the political playing field, and of course there'll be an election in Australia in a few months' time, who is going to try and attract which voters? The Greens, of course, have been very strong on tackling the rental issue and trying to get the one-third of people renting to vote for the Greens. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But the truth is that we've got this intergenerational tension now, and people are saying, well, the boomers have done it really well, and they don't pay much tax. Maybe they should pay a lot more tax. And there's arguments here in the UK that some of those people should pay more tax, whereas younger people are actually under the gun. They can't get into the property market, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a pretty disastrous situation, and it will create contention and social pressures. And then you only have to go and look at the tent cities and those sorts of things, and what you discover there is that most of the people in tent cities are younger people. So, society's broken.
All right, so next up, Australian unemployment.
Yeah, this is just to show you that the growth is weaker. This is one way of looking at it. But interestingly, despite the unemployment rate going up slightly, the jobs availability going down. There's another interesting data point on the next slide that shows you that more people are still having multiple jobs. So to try and get by, more people are doing gig second jobs, third jobs, fourth jobs. I see it in my surveys, and that's having a huge impact. The hours worked goes up, but it's driven by multiple jobs, and there are still a lot more people who want more hours but can't get them as well. So it's a massive impost on a lot of households.
Yeah, and that all ties into the mortgage stress being at record highs.
Yeah, well, just to show you that it's continuing to trend higher, rental stress at 77%, mortgage stress at 51.3%, and the debt to income ratio is still very high. I mean, this is from my own modelling. You can look at the Roy Morgan data that's also showing similar trends, but now it's making the mainstream as well. So there was an article that said that households cut into mortgage repayments as family budgets tighten, and that really is just reiterating what I've been seeing. So there are a lot of households who are really, really struggling now with their ability to be able to make those repayments. There was a recent report from ASIC that said that the hardship schemes run by the banks allow banks to extend and pretend for a year or so, but then those people still have the same problem and it's worse. So in a way, some of these hardship schemes aren't working very well. More people are actually having to rely on them. The banks are actually starting to report higher levels of delinquency now. And so, you can see the cracks beginning to spread. So that's a real concern. And that translates into this other article, which is quite interesting, that says that rising house prices and mortgage stress sparks short-term resale. So there's been a real uptick in people having to sell. So once you go through that year of hardship, you then have to sell. And, you know, there are some significant statistics here in proportions of repeat sales. This is from CoreLogic, that showed that effectively there are a lot of people now being forced to sell. Some of those are investors, but many of those are those people who bought when interest rates were really low, on government schemes, home buyer, et cetera, and are now having to sell to get out again. Guess what? That protects the banks because, of course, prices have actually risen, but it means they've still got the question of where do they live? And so it's creating huge pressure. And I'm afraid that those slides together really just underscore what I've been reporting and seeing in my stress surveys for a long, long time. But now the mainstream are beginning to wake up to it.
Yes. And in the business sector within Australia, we've got weaker profits as well.
Yeah, exactly right. So again, it's spilling over. I see it in my business surveys too, that business confidence slipped back into negative territory. Employment did firm a little in some areas and orders edge up, but it's very weak. And in fact, whether you look at the business survey or whether you look at the reported profitability, it's not in the right place. So not only do we have households under pressure, but we have a lot of businesses under pressure too, a lot of those in the construction sectors we discussed previously. And so economically speaking, the only reason why GDP was as strong as it was because of massive government spending. So government spending is very, very high at the moment. It's supporting effectively a very weak economy. The imports from China and exports really went out of kilter a little bit because there's less trade with China than previously. So economically speaking, things are looking pretty bad. Remember that the economy is meant to support households and businesses, and I would argue that neither are being supported adequately at the moment, so the policies are all over the place.
And next up, so migration is something we've been talking about a lot, and it's topical in the elections all over the world, but this graph really surprised me when I saw this slide, Martin. So back in the 80s and 90s, when it was 20 or 30% of that proportion of population growth from migration, now at 83%.
So this is from Tarek Brooker, and he's done some quite amazing research here that shows that, you know, if you think about new housing demand, 83% of it is coming from migration. Right. Never been higher. And, you know, we've had very strong migration. You know that politicians are now lip servicing. We're going to get it down, et cetera, although whether they will is another interesting factor. So the fact of the matter is one of the reasons why the housing market is so out of kilter is because of massively high migration, whether you go into the rental sector or whether you go into buy. And so unless you dial back migration, you're never going to be able to solve the housing thing. And the next slide is the other thing that Tarek's been looking at. We're actually building relatively more homes per 100,000 people than almost any other country. You can look at it in Australia, Canada, the US, and the UK. So we are building massive amounts. And guess what? We have 5.2% of our population working in the construction sector, right? So it's not like we're not doing stuff. It's just that we're not building enough stuff to meet the demand because of the high migration. And I think this is a very important point because we know from recent data that there's a lot of half-finished properties. They can't finish them because they can't get the labor and they can't get the parts to finish the properties. We also know that a lot of construction sector workers are being sucked into public projects rather than into the housing sector as well. So there are massive, massive issues here. And so the building approvals is way down. And this was a stunning revelation, right? It's not that we're not building. We're building massively more. It's just we're not building enough.
Crazy stuff. So next up, we have seen a bit of an influx of investors back into the housing market.
Well, I think this is the other point. So whilst a lot of first-time buyers can't get in because the borrowing power is down dramatically, investors are rushing back into the market in most in 2 years or so. Housing credit growth is down a little bit. But if you look at the more recent statistics, you can see there's been a significant uptick, particularly in investor lending. And it's interesting that a lot of those investors are now buying down the market. In other words, in the same area of the market as first-time buyers who aspire to buy. And so we're seeing quite strong price growth in that sector of the market, whereas at the top, in the top end, like in Vaucluse, prices are actually dropping quite fast in some areas. So what we're seeing here is now another contention. So again, the haves and the have-nots. We've got a lot of people who can't get in the market, a lot of people who reach and just can get in the market, but then are competing with investors. We've got a lot of investors who are still thinking it's a good time to buy, particularly where there are forced sales. And so, again, it's another market mess. And in the meantime, credit growth continues to be very, very strong, which means it could well drive more prices higher ahead.
All right. Final slide, Martin. Anything to add here with the choppiness?
Well, just to say, housing is broken. You know, when you stand back and look at all of that, all those data points, and then you look at the changes in dwelling values, and you look at the movements in terms of average prices, you know, with prices in New South Wales well above the million now on average, and when you look at the changes in rents and what's happening there, you have to conclude that the whole housing sector is broken. It's broken because of bad policies from governments over many generations, particularly over the last 20 years or so. But the implications for ordinary Australians trying to find somewhere to live is huge. We're seeing these contentions between investors and first-time buyers, where first-time buyers are losing out. We're seeing more interventions from governments to try and sort of prop up the housing market in some ways. The 1.2 million aspirational properties from Albo won't get built. We can't find a way of building them. And so it's an absolute mess, but it's a mess that has been deliberately engineered and deliberately allowed to fester. And, you know, in terms of policies, there are things that could be done, but the fact of the matter is that politicians prefer to look the other way and blame everybody but themselves. The truth is, politics is broken as well.
Yeah, hence our rant at the start. So really great episode. Guys, as always, the links to follow all Martin's work down below and the links to follow all my socials as well. But hope you've enjoyed that one, and we'll see you again next month. Cheers, Martin.
Cheers.